Welcome to Treating Together, formerly Targeted Talks. In this episode, Dr. Edward Kim and Dr. Neil Shah discuss the evolution and current state of lung cancer treatment. They discuss the rapid advancements in lung cancer therapy, challenges community physicians face in staying updated with new data, and the need for better access to clinical trials and new treatments. Both oncologists feel optimistic about the future of lung cancer treatment and emphasize the importance of collaboration between academic and community practices.
Welcome to our lung podcast. This is Real World Challenges and Practical Applications of Emerging Data in Lung Cancer. I'm Ed Kim. I'm physician in chief at City of Hope Orange County and a vice physician in chief for the National Medical Center. And we also have Dr. Shah. Dr. Shah, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, Dr. Kim, thanks for having me on the podcast. And my name is Neil Shah. I'm a professor at Indiana University School of Medicine, and also I'm a community practitioner with Northwest Cancer Centers.
I started practicing lung cancer in 1999. I can tell you, it has been very gratifying to watch this field transform. And I wish it was a linear line, but it was definitely not linear. It was linear flat for the longest time, and then just jumped up at times and made small jumps, big jumps.
You know, it's come such a long way. I completely agree. And I mean, there's so much hope. You know, I saw a few new patients this week, and I was able to tell them, you know, like you were saying, maybe there was, you know, 5-6 chemotherapies during my fellowship in 2007. And now we have, I don't know how many drugs we have for lung cancer, maybe 20 or more. And so I think there's just a ton of hope, as you said.
Yeah. You know, I'll put our lineup of biomarkers against any field right now that's solid tumor. You know, that's breast cancer still doesn't have as many markers as we do, with especially actionable markers with therapies. We're deep in many of these areas with generations of drugs. And so I think it's really led to patients having choices, which is amazing, because I could tell you in the early days, they didn't have a lot of choices for cancer, lung cancer specifically, and B, physicians having choices to place therapies that have become safer, have become more effective. You know, I think a lot of talk that occurs right now is how do we stay updated with that data? You know, you talk about you get to train in academic centers, et cetera, but work in a community type practice. You know, what are your challenges, Neil, as far as staying updated with all the data that's coming out? I mean, I assume you see other patients other than lung cancer as well.
That's absolutely correct. So I think for a community physician like myself, I get all my data basically through email. So, you know, that's why I appreciate those emails from Targeted Oncology conferences. Now, obviously, we can do virtual like we're doing now. I think, you know, most of us in the community, we put in the effort, but I think the fastest way is just technology. You know, and I think specifically for community physician, it's FDA approvals or NCCN guidelines. I mean, I'd say those are the two most important things, because even if I see a new drug combination that looks more effective, you know, many times insurers won't pay for the drugs until they're FDA approved and an NCCN guideline.
And yeah, I mean, it's always a challenge, right? I mean, I do not envy, I've worked in two systems where we've actually hired quite a few and acquired multiple sites in community-based settings, both in North Carolina and now in California. And I have a very high empathy for those docs, because I can't do what they do, which is, you know, see 15 different cancers, know what the FDA approvals are, the latest cutting-edge treatments in first, second, or third line. And by the way, can you even keep track of any clinical trials that are open for each one of these respective cancers? It's so much information.
Oh, we do all that. We certainly do. I have a medical student, a PhD student right with me right now. And yesterday, I think we saw at least 10 different malignancies. And we're not making treatment decisions every day, thankfully. You know, as you were saying earlier, some of our drugs just work, and they work for so long that patients are continued on it with minimal side effects. But I would say the education level of it is daunting, but also exciting. Ultimately, I think technology is our friend, and I think the ability to get that information quickly and make sure, you know, for someone in the community, it's really just what's FDA approved, what line of therapy, what are the options. I think with these tools, we can make the best decisions for our patients.
Yeah, I get privy to seeing a lot of different folks with AI tools, and I don't think a lot of them are true AI that I see, but they like to use the terminology. I think it sounds fancier, more sophisticated, but it is one of those things where we can definitely see where technology and artificial intelligence, as long as it's pulling from right data sources, can be a real assistant and adjunct to a physician, a human. And, I don't know why, we don't have a good AI tool, or maybe there is one out there and I'm just don't see it. But, whenever we get these, these genomic reports, and now they have so many different exons and numbers, even those of us who are experts, we keep a cheat sheet by our desk or have to go to Dr. Google and look up what these really rare submutations are and make sure they're not, they're not inhibitory, or they're resistant, or you can treat a drug. Why is there an AI tool out there that literally can just take that information and give you the top two or three drugs?
I think it's coming. I think some of the companies do a better job than others. Maybe you think that as well. But I agree. I think these will be tools, and I think things are going to get better and better in terms of identifying what truly has the best chance of working. As you know, like, one difficulty for us, as much progress as we made, there's nothing that's 100%, and there's no treatment that's 100% effective to quote unquote cure all cancer, whether it's lung cancer, another type of cancer. Hopefully we'll get there someday, but I agree. Hopefully technology will continue to advance. I feel like, for me, I'm one of the luckiest people to start practicing on my own in 2010, and the explosion of new drugs, new targets, immunotherapy, bispecific antibodies. It's an exciting time to do what we do. I feel like, I'm sure, for you, prior to that, I feel like it wasn't, when I would go with Dr. Bonomi to conferences, I felt like it was the same recycled stuff. And I think it's just been an explosion the last 15 years, and just feel fortunate to be part of it.
Yeah, I ran one of the first trials with defitinib or Iressa early in the days, and that was a real miracle drug. We just didn't study it correctly, and that's trial and error. We had something really valuable, but we didn't look on both sides, and there's certainly missed opportunities there. Pemetrexed, I think, was one of the real hallmarks of changing the chemotherapy effect. Right? Before, it was hard to find that kinder, gentler chemotherapy. You could dose reduce anything down and it would be kinder and gentler, but we were unclear of its overall efficacy. But pemetrexed really changed things as far as, giving that in combination and being a very tolerable drug, albeit limitations with non-squamous. One of the things I wonder about, Neil, is, you mentioned NCCN guidelines. Working at a tertiary referral center versus out in the community practice, the type of patient walking through the door is going to be very different. Does NCCN keep their stuff updated quick enough, or is it just sort of something that helps, but you got to really be a self-learner to find these real updates? And then the patient, is it better, or is it tougher out in the community?
It's tougher. Literally, I just had a patient. The data is clear that a certain combination of drugs is better than another. I ordered the drugs, but because it's not FDA approved, because it's not an NCCN guidelines yet, it's not going to get approved. So I don't know how to expedite that process per se, but it's definitely much tougher. And I think that's where I think some of the industry partners need to do a better job of making sure that they provide the support when they have the data that's going to help the patient. Making sure there's some patient advocacy groups to help. So I think it's just a lot tougher. It's great to have options, but if you can't use those options, that's where things get tough. And unfortunately, things seem to be moving slower, not faster, in regards to that.
And do you see sort of this lag in like the NCCN guidelines as far as getting new drugs posted on there, or is it pretty real time?
I see a big lag. Unfortunately, everyone's doing what they can, but when it comes to patient lives, I think all of us want to be moving as fast as possible. Certainly someone needs to review the data, and you need to have a third party independent, which, in my opinion, I know that's what guidelines and the FDA's for, because we've had mistakes in the past where, you know, maybe something wasn't as effective for a patient. But I definitely see a lag in approval when I see data, especially with not necessarily chemotherapy, but there's a lot of immunotherapy, targeted therapies, bispecifics, and other things that look to be better than chemotherapy. And going back to your point about the chemotherapy, I think, thankfully, we understand how to give drugs better, and the toxicities of these drugs are, you know, we're able to tolerate, patients are able to tolerate it more and more. So I think we're headed in the right direction, but obviously as a community physician, and I want to get my patients the absolute best treatment, hard with FDA not approving it, or, you know, and not being posted on NCCN guidelines, because generally insurance companies, unfortunately, will fight you tooth and nail to give the drug, despite the data clearly showing its benefit.
Yeah, I even wonder. I don't know. I don't look at the NCCN guidelines that often, so, you know, I'm being transparent there. But, you know, zongertinib, you know, a new drug for HER2 mutation in lung cancer, was FDA approved on Friday, April 8th. I don't know if it's on the NCCN guidelines or not. I don't know if you know it or not, but it's it wouldn't surprise me if it wasn't. But, you know, that means any patient who walked in with a HER2 mutation, you know, now has an option for an oral therapy that seems to be very well tolerated and has some really good efficacy and response and DFS data. I knew it was being approved. I didn't know the exact date, but I knew it was going to be approved in early August. You know, how do we get that information other than a company just, you know, mass emailing everybody? How are we going to get that information if it's not showing up in NCCN or these pathway programs that people use? I mean, you can't expect someone to be a self-learner 24/7, 365.
Oh, I think there's a solution to that, actually. And there's a book called Who is Government? And it's about unknown heroes in government who have actually saved people's lives. It's just not marketed properly. For example, there's a lady who created an app for rare diseases. And so there are some diseases that are so rare, there's no place to post, you know, doctor's medication for that or research, whatever. So my point is, without going on too much of a tangent, there should be a central app that has all that information, you know, up, you know, available immediately. Right now, I consider it my responsibility to learn everything. It still is. It always will be. I think if a large insurer like Medicare or the government got involved in something like that, I actually don't think it would be that that expensive, quite frankly. But unfortunately, right now, it seems like investing in science is not as much as I'd like it to be.
And, you know, one of the things we've talked about, you mentioned the barriers and others, is, you know, these real-world challenges in implementation. You know, I'm going to use an example. It's not lung, but, you know, you'll know what I'm talking about. In myeloma, for instance, now, without naming drugs, the second line standard of care changed a few months ago to a CAR-T. Yeah. And when I was in North Carolina, we had 26 sites over North and South Carolina. They weren't campuses. They were regional community sites. Can't do CAR-T out there. And so, how is that affecting you when you know the approved standard? And it was replacement standard. It wasn't you could do this if you can't do something. It was the new standard of care, second line. What kind of limitations on just having that type of drug delivery occur, you know, in your situation or others that you know?
For my community practice, we do clinical trials. To do that, the doctors personally had to make an investment into that program. And so, we did that to help the community. We actually now have more trials than any community hospital in the area. And by the end of the year, we'll have the most trials in the entire state of Indiana. And so we did that to help patients. I don't know how to overcome that barrier otherwise, because most care is obviously delivered in the community in the United States. I will tell you that some patients have the resources to drive to a CAR-T center and others don't. And there's a time, I think, time to get the treatment. And, you know, I will just tell you that, for example, I got a text today about a new cancer patient. I'm seeing that patient tomorrow morning. Most places don't move that fast. Now, we're lucky in that we have enough doctors, we have enough resources that if someone gets something like that, our practice can see that patient with the resources that we have. I know there are many places that just don't have the resources to do something like that. I don't know how to fix that. All I'll say is, in my opinion, when centers are run by physicians and not CEOs and COOs and CFOs and 10 vice presidents, my opinion is that the care is better because there's some thought into, first of all, you know, one way, like we are, first, I think we're just more compassionate and our ethics system is just different. I'll just put it that way. And the physicians are all trying to help patients, but, you know, it matters, as you just pointed out, it matters how fast you're getting a patient in and how much they get treatment. We've all lost patients that waited too long to start their treatment that we probably thought we could save. Some of that is organizational. Some of that is systemic. I can tell you in my practice, I see a second opinion for someone that's been waiting to go to some place for a month. And so I think, you know, that those metrics need to be looked at. I don't think there's an accounting body for a lot of nonprofit hospitals.
Yeah. One of the big efforts that I've been working on for over 10 years now has been eligibility criteria. And I led an effort through ASCO and Friends of Cancer Research where we looked at the study, each study's eligibility criteria. You know, you see research trials, they have 37, 40 eligibility criteria. We do everything we can to keep a patient out of a study rather than everything we can
exactly
to get them in.
Right. You're exactly right. I just had a patient, he had prostate cancer 10 years ago, so he didn't qualify for a trial for CLL.
And that just frustrates people because here you are trying to take extra time to put a patient on. It's out of your busy clinic day and you run into something like that, which makes no sense clinically, no sense from a safety standpoint. And so we did this exercise. We actually published multiple papers, but I wasn't concerned about publishing papers. I was more concerned about action. And those papers actually contained the exact text that we recommended to eliminate these eligibility criteria. And they were adopted actually by CTEP, NCI, in 2020. And then the FDA actually wrote guidance documents in 2022 supporting them. We haven't been able to get the sponsors to change. That's been the big deal. But CTEP's protocol template now has our eligibility criteria recommendations reduced down. This includes things that, like with brain metastases. One of the things that I thought was a really interesting one is that, you know, there was an exclusion criteria called history of HIV. Yet you never even tested for HIV in the study. But if the patient told you they had a history of HIV, then they were out. And we know that now these days, people who have HIV can be doing the same 5-year survival as anyone.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, we just wanted it to be scientific. It's a scientific protocol. If it's the drugs, if it's the antiretrovirals that have a interaction with the study medication, that's science. But saying you have a history of HIV or a history of prostate cancer 10 years ago, that's not science. The second thing we really wanted to address is because everybody said we have to create access for underserved communities. So we got to bring these trials out. And a lot of times it's got to be brick and mortar. And the problem is that I had is that, well, you're going to spend all this money, time, effort to bring these trials out to regional practices in underserved communities, yet you're still going to bring these trials with the same 40 terrible eligibility criteria that'll keep everybody out.
You're preaching to the choir. Enrollment.
We're just here to continue to move it forward. And moving it forward is also paying it forward. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you're an academic center, a community center. I've been in two systems. I went from MD Anderson, one of the top cancer centers in the country, gave up my tenure to go to Carolina's healthcare system and start Levine Cancer Institute in a community non-academic center. And we built a great system that had, we called it an academic hybrid, but my first 27 doctors were all community-based general oncologists. Now I moved to City of Hope. I'm building a second campus in Orange County. First thing I did was we went out and bought a 14 doctor, 7 site practice out in the community, because these types of folks are valuable. They're the first providers that patients are going to see, and we have to keep them well informed. And so, you know, it makes no difference what historical, you know, data was done, et cetera, if we can't apply it to today and really pragmatic. I think that's kind of what our discussion was today, was we've made a ton of progress. Things are going really well with lung cancer. I love the fact that we get confused on therapies, on what we should give to somebody, because we got two or three great therapies. That's a great situation.
Hey, listen, I saw metastatic non-small cells, and I treated them both differently. They had no drivers, but I used different immunotherapies, it's crazy. When I thought about 15 years ago and this week, I thought, man, what a huge difference.
So I think we both agree strongly that it's really been an advanced field. The renaissance has occurred and is still occurring. And I think at the end of the day, the patients are benefiting. And they know, those patients who participated in clinical trials in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, it's an altruistic act. Yes, they want the drug to work for them, but it's so that the next person and the next person could get benefit. So
I was lucky enough to put the first patient on a trial for immunotherapy in Indiana in a community setting. And I know that patient specifically passed away and the drug didn't work for him, but even his family followed up and were happy to hear that now that drug is approved and can help people. So
I think we've had a great talk today, Neil. You know, appreciate that all your insights. I've been on both sides, so I can relate. And I think what's important to take away is that it takes everybody to continue to push this field forward, so that patients have the options, they are given the right options, that we're educating our doctors, both on campuses and community settings, to the best of our ability and a timely ability. The less we do that, the more we just handicap these folks, and then we can't deliver the best medicine. So I think we're very optimistic on how the field is going and where it is going. So I want to thank everybody for listening in.
For more updates on the latest news and trends in oncology, be sure to visit www.targetedonc.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. You can also find us across social media platforms. Follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Targeted Onc, and on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Targeted Oncology. See you next time.